The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Dr. Henry Abramson now presents his lecture, The History of the Blood Libel.
First of all, let us just place the blood libel in the context of the history of anti-Semitism overall. This is a photograph of Jean-Paul Sartre, a very important French philosopher, very much involved with France during the war. And immediately after the war, he wrote a very important book. The cover is shown here, Réflexions sur la question juive, Reflections on the Jewish Question. I read it when I was an undergraduate, and I was blown away by one sentence, which I've included here in the original French. Si le juif n'existait pas, l'antisémite l'inventerait. If the Jew did not exist, the anti-Semite would invent him. And what Sartre meant by this idea was that, you know, in a rapidly changing society with economic change and social change, even definition of gender and gender roles and all kinds of things like this that were going on in 20th century France and really extending further back into the 19th century, anti-Semites are people who are so confused and frightened by what's going on around them that they need to find some kind of lightning rod that will explain the dizzying changes that swirl around them. And they need to find someone to blame to say, well, this is why I didn't get that job. This is why my marriage is not stable. This is why my children don't respect me. And the Jew fits the bill perfectly. And it is a self-fulfilling prophecy, because once there is a history of blaming Jews, then anyone who is, you know, sort of inclined towards this way of thinking will be able to look back and do just a little bit of research and say, oh my gosh, this has been going on for centuries and centuries upon centuries. And so it builds upon itself in a very macabre way. However, anti-Semitism is not monolithic. One of the most fascinating things about this unique human hatred is that it is able to adapt itself to remarkably different intellectual, cultural, social, religious climates. For example, you see here one of two translations of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion in Japanese, where there are only about somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 Jews in Japan. Why does Japan need two translations of this notorious anti-Semitic forgery? Well, it just shows that it's speaking to a need that is much deeper than the actual presence of Jews or their role in the economy and so on. So anti-Semitism is able to find ways to enter into the healthy body politic of a society and develop a vocabulary that speaks to people who are susceptible to this unique intellectual contagion. There are basically four distinct periods of anti-Semitic ideology. I'd like to go through them very quickly now, because we're going to focus on the third of the fourth, the medieval period. Each one of them is quite distinct and has features which make it adaptable to that particular climate in which it existed. One quick note before we go in further, I am going to be using the term anti-Semitism anachronistically, meaning this is a term that was invented in the 1880s by this man, Wilhelm Marr, in one of his many books attacking Jews. Here this is The Way, the victory of Germanness over Jewishness. And in it, he tried to find a German term that would replace the vulgar term Judenfeinde or Judenhass, Jew hate. This was considered like not a term that you could use in polite society, so he invented a new term. He borrowed from linguistic theory that was developing the idea of language families, like Romance languages, Slavic languages, and Semitic languages, which of course includes, you know, Arabic and Syriac and things like that, but you know, that's not what he was thinking about. And he says, I'm not anti-Jewish, I am anti-Semitism. I am against Semitism. And he defines Semitism as essentially the world Jewish conspiracy. So being an anti-Semite meant, oh, you're a perfectly reasonable person and love everyone and, you know, in favor of diversity and inclusion, all those things, but I hate those Jews who are engaged in conspiracy. So it's a term that was coined in the 1880s by anti-Semites It was later claimed by Jews in a transvaluation of the term. We will use it anachronistically to refer even to much earlier forms of anti-Semitism. Okay, so the first period is called classical xenophobia. Xenophobia basically means the fear of the stranger. Xenos in Greek is stranger or foreigner, and phobia, of course, is phobia. So this is something that we see in the Greco-Roman world in particular, that they have a lot of nasty things that they will say about Jews, but almost always those nasty things are based on a misunderstanding of what Jews really stand for. So, for example, they would accuse the Jews of being unusually slothful, of lazy. Why? Because we take off an unprecedented 1 day in 7 for Shabbos. This was unheard of for regular Romans or Greeks to have such a frequent number of holidays in the year. They would accuse us of clannishness and misanthropy because you could not become a Jew unless you agreed to go through a full conversion, which of course meant that you had to, immerse in a mikvah, you had to be circumcised for your male, you had to develop a taste for Chinese food. There was a lot of things that were involved, and they had, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. I'm just trying to get away from the bad stuff. And so most of the anti-Jewish things that the Greeks and Romans said, and they were distinctly nasty, they were based on sort of normal human hatreds. Like when you have a neighbor who is Cuban or Korean or Eskimo or whatever, you may see some things that your neighbor does and you don't like them. It's natural to have kind of an antipathy to things which are different. And so Jews participated in, to a certain degree, the normal level of hatred in the ancient period. That, for example, in the Arch of Titus that's shown here, that has this famous bas-relief showing the Roman taking of spoils from Jerusalem to Rome. It's really not an anti-Semitic image. It is a piece of war propaganda celebrating a Roman triumph. The Jews happen to lose, but there's nothing distinctly warped about it. They would say the same things about the barbarians, about the Scythians, about any other people they conquered. They would do the same kind of, anti that particular people propaganda, and so it's hard to say that it is a unique and pathological hatred. We will see, however, that developing, especially with the birth of Christianity. So the second period is what's sometimes called Christian anti-Judaism, which is basically something that is a different kind of antipathy that grows out of the friction between Judaism as the mother religion and Christianity as the daughter religion. As Christianity tries to define itself in opposition to its parent religion, and essentially to invent a series of rituals and practices that are distinct from Jewish rituals and practices so that their new followers can adhere to them, they end up having to demean the mother religion. I often tell my undergraduates kind of an analogy. If you imagine that there's a family that has been eating cholent in a particular way for generations, and then they send away the daughter to school, and she enjoys, going to Brandeis or whatever very much. And when she comes home for Thanksgiving, she says, "Oh, Mom, you won't believe it, Besides the fact that I enjoyed JLI very much on campus, I was a Sinai scholar, it was great, I also learned this great new cholent recipe. It involves oranges and peanut butter. And it's so fantastic." And the mother's a little skeptical, but they try it that Shabbos. And the daughter says, "So what do you think of my new cholent recipe?" And the mother says, this actually does have to do with ancient Judaism, Christianity, don't worry. The mother says, "Okay, it's interesting, but in reality, Shana Fruma, it's not as good as your Bobby's recipe. It's interesting, but it's not what we want to eat every week." And the daughter gets upset and says, "What are you talking about? This is so much better." And they argue and argue. And as the argument gets worse, Shana Fruma starts saying, "You know what? Not only is my cholent better, but I have to say, I always hated your cholent. That it always made me feel really gassy afterwards and bloated. And I couldn't eat for 2 days. And the smell of it as a leftover when my brother would put it in the microwave was terrible." And so the promotion of the new cholent eventually becomes a demotion of the old cholent. As the Protestant theologian, very heroic scholar named Rosemary Radford Ruther once put it, anti-Semitism is the left hand of Christology. As you try to promote Christianity as distinct from the mother religion, you have to also put down Judaism. And so there's a unique kind of dynamic that is not the same as what the Romans or the Greeks had with the Jews. This is only something that is possible when you have a new religion emerging from the mother religion. So here's just a couple of examples of that expression in Gothic and early modern art. You can see the on the left, these are, by the way, there are hundreds upon hundreds of examples of this particular motif. It's called Ecclesia et Synagoga, church versus synagogue, or church and synagogue. And it was frequently used as, it was frequently used when, peasants would come to the cathedral and the priest would need to explain, what is Judaism, what is Christianity, and these illiterate peasants, quite frequently the priests were also illiterate, would resort to art to explain complex ideas. On the left you have, on the left you have, always on the left, Ecclesia, who is shown here with a crown, obviously indicating royalty. She's holding the chalice. Her bodice is done up properly. She's got a staff that is intact, indicating temporal power, whereas her sister, the synagogue, is blindfolded to the truth. She is blind to see the truth of Christianity. She's lost her crown. Her staff is broken, meaning she has no more power. She's holding on to the Ten Commandments here, but she's holding on to them loosely. They're falling out of her grasp. All of this is meant to say that, Judaism may have once been the favored child, but now it's Christianity, that it has shifted. This is the new people, the new chosen people, as it were. And this was a very convincing image used all over the place. Here's another example from Werben, Germany. It's a stained glass window. You have the ecclesia with the crown, the staff, the chalice, riding on a tetramorph, right, which is a noble beast taken from Ezekiel. And synagogue, on the other hand, is holding on to the head of a ram, indicative of its attachment to the carnal sacrifices. The crown falling off, the staff broken, the blindfold, and riding on a donkey, a sterile animal, or I think that's a mule, actually. And what I think is the most dramatic contrast is, emerging from the heavens, a hand crowns the church with a halo, and on the other hand, for Ecclesia, a sword comes down and is driven into the top of Ecclesia's skull, which is about as clear a sign of divine disapproval that you could imagine. So this is a new kind of like stage of anti-Semitic thought, which is primarily a theological dispute between priests and rabbis that, says that Christianity is the better religion. But it doesn't necessarily descend into people. It doesn't necessarily express itself, especially in, very expensive sponsored church art, into attacks on people. That's something that we see in the period we're going to study today. I'm not going to go into great detail right now because we're going to focus on one key element, the blood libel. But this happens to be perhaps the most well-known image of the blood libel. This is the 1493 Weltchronik, which was originally published with a huge text underneath it. I have not included in this image. All of the figures here are labeled, and the huge text underneath in medieval German would explain what's going on. But basically, it has Simon here of Trent, 1479, and he's been captured. He's held in a cruciform position by a number of Jews. You can see they're all Jewish because they're wearing the ruel, which is a badge that was imposed on Jews in 1215 by the Fourth Lateran Council. Some of them have the Judenhut, the Jewish hat that was also from that council. And they're doing various horrible things to his body, including imitations of the wounds of Jesus, circumcising him, because of course Jesus was also circumcised, and collecting his blood in a pan, which will later be used for a whole host of bizarre purposes that really run the gamut of everything from being included in the recipe for matzah to being a potion for Jewish men to drink because they suffer iron loss through menstruation, which affects both sexes according to this ideology. The blood is useful as a used as an aphrodisiac, love potion number nine. Do you remember that song? Because of my head. So aphrodisiac, and there are even some bizarre stories collected in the work of Joshua Trachtenberg of, Christian couples who have difficulty conceiving going up to Jewish families and saying, listen, you know, we promise we won't tell, but we really, could we just have some of that Christian blood? Because we need it for ourselves. And these beliefs were rampant in medieval society. Now, why is this different from the previous period? It's because this is when anti-Semitism just goes off the rails. It is totally pathological and weird at this point. In the earlier period of Christian anti-Judaism, you know, it was a theological debate. You can bring a pasuk, I'll bring a pasuk, we'll argue, we'll have a debate, we'll have a dialogue. And it's still within the realm of rational, you know, talk. Now it gets into some bizarre kind of like deep-seated psychological fears, and it has an incredible staying power and wreaks incredible havoc on the Jewish world. It is, unlike the previous period, very much directed at individual people and actual Jewish communities, and of course it finds its expression in violence, which is not something which is deeply associated with the previous period. The last period, which we will not cover today, but just to round it out, modern anti-Semitism. You know, one of the challenges of modernity, especially since the Enlightenment, which if you're hanging around tomorrow, I'll speak more about it, the 18th century, is a move away from religion. There's a decline in religious faith among, you know, not only Jews, but also Christians in a very big way. And so all of these religious elements that Jews need to, like, reenact the passion through the murder of a Christian child or things like that, those are hard to really sell in the modern period. There will be attempts, but so anti-Semitism sort of loses its major religious character and becomes a secular phenomenon. And the two main things that Jews are accused of now, which are not specifically religious, are that they are involved in a conspiracy, which you see here, some Nazi propaganda, which clearly indicates all of the interacting lines of Jews involved in various types of plots. And secondly, that it is based on race, that there is this new idea that circulates in the 19th century of distinct races and unique racial characteristics, and the Jewish characteristic, the characteristic of the Jewish race, is to be parasitic, that Jews find their ways to healthy societies, they glom onto them and eat away at them like cancer until the society falls into decay and the Jew moves on to another society. Those are not religious ideas, but those are the ones that animate modern anti-Semites more than any other. We see it very prominently in our own days with, COVID was something that Jews were held responsible for. Even, you know, last month it was in the news as well, bizarre things associated with it. But that's not our topic for today. We're going to go into the medieval period. The scope of the blood libel, as you can see on this map here from Encyclopedia Judaica, it's quite large across the continent. It begins in England, and we'll talk about that first case, in 1144. And one of the really interesting questions that was asked by a scholar named Rose, who recently published a book on this, why all of a sudden England, 1144, we never hear anything like this. And then all of a sudden, it spreads across all of Europe. All of these circles here, you can see the darker circles represent 19th and 20th century examples. It just becomes a mania. Everybody is talking about the blood libel after this one incident in 1144. It just spreads throughout, and it's unusually pervasive and addictive. It's like it multiplies upon itself. People are attracted to the idea of the blood libel in a very significant way. How does it actually work? Well, for the most part, the story is basically the same. It begins, unfortunately, with the discovery of a body, typically of a young boy. This is something which, in the course of human history, Rahman al-Itzlan, there are always horrific individuals who prey on children. And there are nebuch always victims. And so you can imagine when a body is discovered, and especially if it's been abused or tortured, then the local population is obviously, you know, extremely upset and angry. And they'll cast about looking for who is this possibly who is responsible for this horrible act. And the blood libel argues that it was the Jewish community who seized this young child and then, you know, went through a reenaction of the crucifixion for various, you know, religious purposes. Sometimes it's called ritual murder. And then the story gets embellished with the other aspects of it, like the use of the blood, as we've described. So that's basically how this story unfolds. But there were certainly murders of children before 1144. How come it just begins there and then never lets go of the popular psyche? That's one of the questions that we'll have to look at. Another related charge, which we should spend a minute talking about because they seem to be in the same family of ideas, is something called host desecration. This is something that really gets traction in the 14th century and on. And unlike the blood libel, which was usually opposed by the church felt that the blood libel was really, the Jews would petition the Pope and would say, hey, you know, come on, the people are saying these crazy things about us. And the Pope would frequently issue bulls saying, no, it's not true. They don't drink Christian blood. Please don't accuse the Jewish community of this kind of activity. But it was something that even the popes could not control. And at a certain point, they said, well, you know, we can't control it. Perhaps we should take advantage of it. That's something that we'll see here. The reason for the advantage is because they were also advancing a doctrine known as transubstantiation, which is a key element in Catholic practice, where after a Catholic, confesses sins and receives penance and does, acts of contrition, then he or she is allowed to participate in a ritual called communion, which involves, as I'm sure you're aware, the ingestion of a small wafer or a small cube of bread in the Orthodox Church and a small drink of wine or grape juice, which symbolizes the body and blood of Jesus. And it's kind of a strange ritual. I guess I've never really understood how, but there it is. It's, you know, I'm certainly not an expert on Catholicism. I barely know Judaism, so. But this is what you do. So now here's the thing. If the whole idea of ritual murder is that the Jews are accused of wanting to reenact the Passion, then certainly they should want to do it to the communion wafers as well. If the communion wafer, according to the doctrine of transubstantiation, actually is the body of Jesus, not a symbolic transformation, but an actual transformation somehow, then Jews must want to also do the same thing to the wafers. And it's called the host. That's the name for the wafer. So in the 14th century, this new version of blood libel, which does not need the body of a child to perpetuate itself, suddenly becomes extremely popular. Here's one of my favorite examples of the propaganda from a host desecration in Passau, Germany, also 14th century, if I remember correctly. And here, again, you're catering to a lot of illiterate readers, so it has kind of like a manga version of the story. Here you have, and the stories are very typical, they always involve very similar themes. Here is a Christian accomplice who goes into the church. He opens up the sacristy and he steals the wafers. You can see them listed here. He looks over his shoulder as he sweeps them into his bag. He goes then to the Jews. You can see they're wearing the ruel here to identify them. He shows them what he's brought, and they point to the money that they pay him. The Jews then bring it back to their synagogue, where they engage in torturing the host. You can see here the artist, obviously unaware of how to write Hebrew, but wants to kind of represent some sort of gibberish over here. And they've got the host. They stab it, and it bleeds miraculously, right? Reinforcing the idea of transubstantiation. Then the police become suspicious, and they knock at the door. What's going on there? And while one Jew sort of distracts the policeman, the other one tries to gather up the evidence. They take it to the oven, and they throw the wafers in the oven, and miraculously, the figure of a small child appears. Doves fly out of the smoke that are caught by the willing angels. And this kind of like, you know, body of ideas comes together to really reinforce the validity of the whole idea of transubstantiation. So you can see why the church would be more enthusiastic about this than about blood libel. Now, up until this part, this is all fiction. None of this actually happened. The next parts of the story, however, frequently happened, where there will be, you know, angry villagers burst into the synagogue. They engage in beheading some of the Jews who are involved in this. They set others alight after torturing them, burning them alive. The Christian accomplice is then taken over for more punishment, and the synagogue is then rededicated as a church. So the whole idea of the blood libel sort of gets a promotion with the host desecration charge in the 13th century. And like the blood libel, it has a remarkable spread. And we see it going all through Western Europe, all the way out to the Ural Mountains, for reasons which I am still puzzled by, and maybe someday I'll figure it out. It does not seem to be very popular in France, which is surprising because France, being a Catholic country and trying to promote the idea of transubstantiation, you'd think it would be more popular. But as they say in French, azoy, that's not French, but you know. So this is the same thing that happens with the host desecration. So now, by the time we get to this period, I've given you sort of like an overview of the history of anti-Semitism and where blood libel and its related charge, host desecration, fit in the medieval period. The really distinct aspect of it is that it is complete lunacy. It has nothing to do with logic and preys on human fears, and sometimes is used to justify the understanding of who could possibly murder a young child, Rahman al-Islam. But now we should look at four case studies. So let's go to four case studies and try to understand a little bit more about how this works out. So the first case is, in many ways, really quite unique. William of Norwich. Here you can see one of the very, very few representations of William of Norwich. And actually, this is like was made 400 years later and placed in a church, not in Norwich, but in nearby Norfolk. And the scholar Rose, who recently wrote a remarkable book on this, published by Oxford University Press, he goes back to the actual story. We have one recorded account of it that was written about 6 years after it happened. And he unpacks a totally different story than you would expect. What we definitely know happened is that this young child, William, was found murdered and presumably raped and mutilated. The community was very upset. He was buried. But the Jews were not at the time blamed for the crime. And in fact, 6 years passes before anyone starts to even, you know, raise the question of Jews being involved. And the only reason why it was involved, why it was brought up, was by a particular churchman named Thomas of Monmouth. We don't know who killed William, by the way. It's an unsolved mystery. But this one particular churchman wrote an account which brought in this idea that William was specifically murdered because the Jews wanted to reenact the Passion. And this did not seem to get very much traction with even the family of William in Norwich. It just seemed like a phantasmagoric kind of lie that no one could really handle. However, we should recall that this occurred within the context of the Second Crusade. In fact, the second one we're going to look at, the Blois incident, also is in the context of that crusade, which was a disastrous moment in Christian history. And it happened that this new idea of Jews engaging in this kind of behavior served a lot of political and economic purposes. Let's just recall what's the story with the Crusades. The First Crusade began in December of 1095 when Pope Urban II was incensed that the Muslims who controlled the Holy Land were apparently not allowing Christian pilgrims to visit the holy sites in Jerusalem, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and so on. And so he thought of this great sort of like flash mob idea that really took hold for various reasons, social and economic in particular, of gathering together all Christian soldiers and following the cross. That's what the term crusade means, following the cross, to Jerusalem to wrest it from the control of the infidel Muslim. So in 1096, they set off, and amazingly, they were successful, at least temporarily. By the time the Muslims ejected them from the land of Israel, they had, you know, cut a path of devastation through Europe until they finally were able to plant a foothold in the land of Israel. They would then repeat this attempt several times over the next couple hundred years with more or less success. And of course, we have today many remarkable pieces of Crusader architecture in the land of Israel. The Second Crusade, however, was a disaster. I forgot to mention one very important point about the First Crusade. There were a group of Crusaders, not the typical Crusaders who were like official knights with resources, horses, caddies, things like that, who were concentrated in the Rhineland. And following one individual named Peter the Hermit in particular, and under the direction of a few especially wicked Crusaders, they said, why are we bothering to schlep all the way to Jerusalem? I'm sure they used the word schlep. Why are we bothering to take ourselves all the way to Jerusalem to fight non-believers when we have Jews living right here, unbelievers living right here in Germany, in Speyer and Worm, Mainz, Köln, all kinds of places? Why are we going all the way there if we're supposed to, like, you know, fight for Christ? We can do it right here in Germany. And so in the summer of 1096, there were horrific, horrific massacres wreaked on Jewish communities in early Ashkenaz, in these towns along the Rhine River in particular, that left a huge cultural and intellectual scar on the Jewish psyche. And we still think about it today. Every Shabbos we read Av HaRachamim and Shul. That's a prayer specifically for the martyrs of that time. Many Jewish families actually engaged in collective suicide rather than give themselves up to the Crusaders for forced baptism. So that was like an experience of the First Crusade. It was definitely not sanctioned by the church. This violence was actually opposed by the church, and bishops often gave sanctuary to the Jews within their castles to try and protect them, but they were unsuccessful. The Second Crusade, however, was a disaster for the church. They did not take Jerusalem. And when they came back from their unsuccessful wars, they were saddled with debts, which had been suspended. The payment was suspended while they were on crusade, but afterwards they've come back and they've got to pay back all their debts. It's a very expensive thing to mount, you know, a transcontinental attack like this. And it happened that in the town of Norwich, there was a returned failed crusader who was, you know, erstwhile a member of, let's say, the upper middle class, who was now on very hard times. And he murdered a Jewish moneylender. And the case came to court. And the defense was essentially a what about it kind of argument, where the defense said, why are we blaming this man, you know, not denying that he actually killed this Jewish moneylender, but why are we blaming this man when we know that the Jews murdered William of Norwich? And here he is, he, you know, went on crusade, he did all kinds of things for our Christian world, and now he's come back, and in this, you know, argument with a Jewish moneylender, he murders him. But you know what? The Jews deserve it because they kill Christian children. And the trial, this is the first time anyone had ever heard of this, the trial ended up in a deadlock. And they accepted the argument of the defense, and they said, well, we really can't, you know, convict him of this crime because, I guess, yeah, the Jews killed William of Norwich. This proved to be an extremely powerful idea that certain elements in society could use, especially if they had debts to Jewish moneylenders, if they were involved in various kinds of arrangements that he wanted to dissolve themselves of. And so part of the reason for the toehold that ritual murder achieved in Europe was a result of this very successful defense. See the work, William of Norwich, by Professor Rose. It's really quite amazing. A great illustration of this is something, the second blood libel that we have on the books, the Blois incident of 1171. The Blois incident, there's really not much to say about it because we have very little data. We don't even have any representations of it. That's why I'm just showing you a map of where Blois is. The story in Blois did not even involve a body. It was quite unique. No body of a child was found. All that was involved was a particular Christian servant was walking by the riverbank. He saw a Jew who was adjusting a load of animal skins on the back of his donkey, and the servant thought he saw that one of those animal skins was actually the body of a Christian child. And so he went back and he reported it, and essentially what happened is the local count of the region believed it and supported a mass arrest of a whole bunch of Jews, including one particular woman, Pulcelina, with whom he had an economic relationship, maybe something a little bit more than that as well, it's quite possible, but he jailed her and all these moneylenders, and they ended up killing 30 Jews. It was a horrific story, and no one ever claimed that a child was missing. No one ever claimed that they have seen a body other than a servant who was looking at some animal skins, and they never found the person who was carrying the animal skins. It was an entire fiction, but it seemed to have captured the imagination of the population and resulted in violence. What was especially useful here, though, is like in the murder of William Norwich, it involved the catalyst of one official vote of approval from the local count of Blois that authorized this strange belief and actually allowed it to translate into violence. It also, conveniently for him, absolved him of all his debt to Pulcelina and others. And so this is where you see the whole idea of the blood libel. Its fictional nature does not hinder its advancement in the popular psyche, which is, I think, quite terrifying. When we move just a little bit further, this is the classic story of blood libel, there are hundreds and hundreds of representations of the murder of Simon of Trent, not too far from Italy. This is quite a bit later, 1479, but it was one that the church got behind much more expansively than they had ever before. And this, like we saw with Blois, with the kind of the ascent of a person in power, made a huge difference. William of Norwich, that we mentioned the first case, you know, when he was murdered, he was buried, and there was no argument, there was no discussion of the Jewish community somehow being responsible, but as his status grew, he was interred and reinterred four times, meaning promoted to higher and higher positions because his relics were then worshipped, meaning his actual bones were then a pilgrimage site for people who wanted to see the martyr of Norwich. This became even more prominent with Simon of Trent. And this young child, who was in fact found murdered, he was actually beatified by the church, meaning they moved him up to the level where if they could just report a few more miracles in his name, then he would be a saint. And so there was actually a process of sainthood for Simon. Now, it happened that the Jewish community was you know, incensed and continued to be incensed about it. And after Vatican II, eventually the Catholic Church said, okay, we know it's not true that Simon of Trent was murdered by Jews for his blood, so I guess we have to remove this individual from the official martyrology, and we're not going to process his sainthood. But nevertheless, this was a case where the church itself saw the value, the utility of promoting a new saint. Just like with host desecration, there were reasons why it could serve its purposes. Moving to the last example, and then we're going to take it to the 21st century, the notorious Bayliss case. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. This young man, Andrei Yushchinsky, was murdered most likely by some underworld figures who were involved with his mother. But after the body was found, a hue and cry was raised in Kyiv in 1911, and suspicion fell on a young bricklayer named Mendel Bayliss, who was completely innocent of the crime. What was unique about this case for our purposes is that the Russian government, this is again before the communist era, this is the last Tsar Nicholas II, 1911. This is 20th century, right? My grandparents were alive when this happened. The Russian government put its full force of prosecutorial power and energy and resources to actually try to claim that Jews murder children for their blood, bringing in all kinds of crazy hocus-pocus experts who would actually swear that this is actually what Jews do. And it was the laughingstock of the rest of the world. Nobody could believe that Russia was so backward. I can't believe I'm standing here in 2023 saying that sentence. Nobody could believe that Russia was so backward. But that's exactly what was happening in 1911. And the case was magnificently defended by a series of Russian Jewish lawyers. I recently heard someone told me that the Rebbe Rashab was very involved in the legal defense as well, and organizing it and so on. The Russian prosecution was unable to convince a jury of Ukrainian peasants that Jews had murdered Andrei Yushinsky, and Mendel Bayliss went free. So this was actually one that had something of a happy ending, although the blood libel continued to circulate, of course, well into the Nazi period. So in the final minutes I have, I'd like to take you to one of the most disturbing elements of this story, and that is the work of a particular artist named Gasparo in Italy. He's a hyper-realist Catholic artist who specializes in some really very moving, powerful works of art, and the style of his art is almost photographic in nature. So I'm going to show you one of the most difficult pieces. I apologize, but this is the challenge here. This is a piece of art that Gasparo came out with in March of 2020. And it is dedicated to Simon of Trent. It represents the murder of Simon in 1479, the one that I showed you the beginning of this lecture from the Weltchronik of 1493. And Gasparo has breathed new life into this horrific charge for our times. Here's a better look at it in its fullness. Here you can see how the whole thing is two pieces. It's designed to go over an altar. I do not believe it has found a permanent home yet. But on the top, you see that the cherubim, the baby angels, are incredibly pained over the massacre of this, or so-called massacre of this child. And then when you look at the detail, you see these horrific, modern-looking Jews, many of which are very Hasidic in nature, with payas and so on, and they're strangling young Simon, whose face is in a paroxysm of fear and pain, and they're gleefully engaging in all of the wounding that we saw in the Weltchronik and so on, and all of the worst examples of Nazi iconography with the hooked noses and the fleshy lips and things like that. It is one of the most grotesque examples of anti-Semitism, and it borrows from this medieval myth and circulating even today. Even though this challenge of anti-Semitism is something that has dogged the Jews for almost 1,000 years, almost a millennia, nevertheless, Netzach Yisroel lo yishaker, we have somehow found ways to survive despite the incredible challenges, and we are still here working today. I want to thank you very much for your endurance in this very difficult topic.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.